got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Folta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Thank you for joining us. Kevin, what's going on, my friend?
No comment. I am in the eye of the storm, and I ain't liking it one bit. No, it is such a pleasure to be able to sit down and talk about science and read the beautiful stories and share the beautiful stories that the swirl of nonsense around us can sometimes be forgotten. And so that I'll leave it right there. More to come. Tune in later.
Yeah, we might have some juicy details to discuss at some point. With that said, though, I don't have that level of drama in my life, but I did make it onto Source Watch as a science denier or a corporate shill. I'm not quite sure what it is, but if you're not familiar, SourceWatch is like, it's like a wiki, but it's put on by this nonprofit group that just attacks people that more or less take mainstream scientific views. So I'm on here and I am I'm a climate change denier. Somebody, I'm not going to say who, but somebody listened to one of our recent episodes where we talked about ending climate hysteria. And they said, well, you know, English is a science, a climate change consensus denier.
Well, that's so they're run by the Center for Media and Democracy, which isn't the worst organization in the world in general. They're in Madison, Wisconsin. And I've reached out to them because I have a SourceWatch page that does not match my real life at all. And when I read it, I'm reading it and I'm going, oh my God. I guess I'm known as the GMO professor. And they don't mention anything about, you know, about scholarship and years of work in several various areas of compelling science, training students, dozens of PhDs, hundreds of international scholars and undergraduate research opportunities that shape the careers of students going forward. No, they say that I really like Gordon Peterson. and it's like that I defend Gordon Peterson, and it's like, really? I mean, this is like a major thing for them anyway. Yeah. It's nuts.
I love that they've tried to paint you as this sort of like right wing hitman for corporate America. It's so goofy because anyone that listens to this for more than 12 minutes knows that your politics don't matter, but you're very, like, you're just the middle of the road kind of guy. You have positions on different issues that I think could be considered left or right. So there's no like, yeah, hire me and I'll defend tobacco for you. You know, like that's not what happens. And even in my case, I'm small potatoes compared to a figure like Kevin. But 12 years ago, I had my first science journalism internship. And as a part of that, I interviewed a scientist who takes a contrary view on climate change. So I interviewed him and I said, hey, you know, you've published papers in journals and you work at a reputable institution. I'm talking about Roy Spencer at the University of Alabama at Huntsville. So he's well known and he's a controversial figure, but I interviewed him. And so they portrayed this as like, English interviewed Spencer. He let people comment in response, but he gave Spencer the final say. It's like, whoa, yeah. Give me a break, you know? So anyways, I'm reveling in this and I don't care what happens. I'd rather dig ditches than kowtow to these people. So there you go. Well, there's that.
I just turned on their page now and it's a defense of Jordan Peterson. I never can remember which one it is, even though I'm one of his disciples. But the one beautiful thing here is that they have this industry ties and they just pull a quote from Lipton's libelous article that says that Folta is part of an inner circle of industry consultants, lobbyists, and executives who devised a strategy on how to block efforts to mandate GMO labeling And like I'm on the inner circle of industry consultants, lobbyists, and executives. I have never heard, maybe my wife's corporation. I'm on the inner circle. No, I mean, they are so wrong about everything. And the thing is, their sponsors are like legit sponsors, like the Ford Foundation. And I wrote letters to all their sponsors and said, do you really realize that this place you're giving money to is hurting people who are legit? And you know how many responses I got back?
I'm going to say zero.
Zero.
Yeah.
And so I would urge anybody listening, if you want to take a look at SourceWatch, look up some of your favorite scientists and see how they fare. And, you know, maybe blow in the ear of a Ford Foundation or one of their other funders, because these are legitimate organizations that could be using their money to do things that are good, that are actually funding very bad people.
Yeah. You know, another thing I noticed is they just take unobjectionable statements. So I wrote an article recently and I said that there's no evidence that the herbicide Paraquat causes Parkinson's disease. And I was relying on a giant, we talked about it. There was a big review that was just published and I wrote an article about it. And I said, there you go. There's the data. And they just said, he says, there's no evidence that Paraquat causes Parkinson's. And they just leave it at that. Like it's this, how dare you? Anyways, enough.
How dare you? Yeah. How dare you?
All right, enough of this ego stroking. I just couldn't help it. I just like
no, but you have to because this is what the average person who's trying to seek good scientific information, where they will try to go. And SourceWatch, you hear Center for Media and Democracy, you go, you know what's wrong with that, right? And you look at some of their other stuff and you kind of go, okay, I see where they are. Let's see what they say about this Cameron English guy. And they basically take everything good that you've ever done in your life and thrown it out the window and then distort anything that they can bend. And it just is a very common thing in social media. But the problem is it's the anchor we have to drag. And that means that we have to tile it up with good media and good podcasts that are entertaining and interesting. So we better try harder.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's with that in mind, let's jump into this one, which I think is going to be a pretty good episode. So first up, a psychological deep dive into the minds of COVID vaccine refuseniks. Next, living longer, genes set limits, but diet and exercise can extend lifespans. And finally, how the brain drives food addiction. I think these are all cool stories, but this first one, Kevin, I thought was particularly interesting. So tell us about this.
Yeah, so I really like this one. And this is Viewpoint, a psychological deep dive. It was done by Richard Redding in October 22 of this year. And the whole idea is based upon the idea that the Kaiser Family Foundation tells us that there are some amount of Americans, somewhere between 15 and 25%, that say they will never get the COVID vaccine. And it really makes you wonder why. Because back in 2020, we think back to the beginning of the pandemic in March and April, when the idea of a vaccine was just being born, everybody really was on the same page that, yes, this will be an exciting thing if we have a preventative against this virus. And at the time, we didn't know how bad it was going to be. We didn't know how contagious it was going to be. We had a president who was igniting this Project Warp Speed, which had a horrible name for vaccination development. And it seemed to transcend political boundaries because you had the left and the right kind of uniting against this one idea, at least at the surface at the beginning. And a president who at least was not getting in the way of vaccine development, although not being connected to real public discourse with medical experts. So the thing was, is that you had everybody kind of on the same page. And as we got through the year of 2020, and the vaccine became imminent, and once the vaccine was here, you started to see a group of people emerge who were making profound statements about why they would not be vaccinated. And none of it was what you heard back in the beginning. These were all statements that were being made because of what they read somewhere else. Somebody told them, It's only emergency use authorization. It's an experimental vaccine. It is made from fetal cells. You know, all the BS that we heard around the vaccination. And this was amplified by the disinformation dozen, all those folks on social media. It's 12 accounts that spread 65% of the bad information. And so that's really where this started out, was the birth of this group of people who are recalcitrant to a public health initiative. And what are they all about? And that's really where the article goes.
Overall, I say it's a great article and there's a lot of insight. And I think to the extent that he's talking about the anti-vaccine movement that is just going to oppose any vaccine, it's 100% correct. And we've talked before about Children's Health Defense, which is Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s group. You know, at the minute the pandemic hit, they started talking about how, you know, well, this was planned and they were just waiting for the right virus to come along. And then when the vaccines came out, they just started reporting VAERS data every single week and saying, look, you know, another 10,000 people reported that their arms fell off. And then they would just take it as gospel that was true. And as we've talked about before, you can't just cite VAERS data like it's verified, because it's not. It actually has to be investigated. But there's a few things I wanted to point out. I think there's a lot of people today who are vaccine hesitant or skeptical or whatever, they're refuseniks, whatever phrasing you want to use. But I think they have some legitimate concerns. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. Here's one. So California Governor Gavin Newsom just last week jumped into a lawsuit to help the state correctional officers union avoid a vaccine mandate that he put in place in the state. So as he's telling everyone in California that they have to be vaccinated, their kids have to be vaccinated to go to school. Once the FDA approves the shot for the children's age group, they have to get it too. And then he's going to court and he's saying, well, these people who are older and are more likely to have diabetes and heart disease, which are risk factors for COVID, they don't have to get the shot. And they're around people that can't go anywhere, prisoners. And the argument that they're making in court, I kid you not, I wrote about this. You can look up the documents from the lawsuit. The argument that the governor of California is making is that, well, the prisoners can get vaccinated, and getting vaccinated is the best way to protect yourself. Therefore, the prison guards who donate money to my campaigns don't have to get vaccinated. So he's making the same argument in court that he is rejecting in public, because there's people saying that. They're like, look, you get vaccinated if you want to protect yourself. I don't have to. So you have this kind of hypocrisy going on. And we've talked about examples before, but as long as that's going on, I don't know that we can just say, well, these people, they just have some cognitive bias that prevents them from understanding science. I don't think that's a complete picture of the situation.
Oh, you're exactly right. That's one example. At the federal level, you know, the Biden administration said, we will, and I agree with this, that the federal employees should have to receive the vaccine in order to be going to work. And except for the post office, because USPS is a very powerful union that said, no, we're not going to do it. And so they, and being the post office union is typically leans very much in support of left leaning initiatives. They had to go along with it because they can't upset their base. And it's the same thing left or right. Earlier, you made a comment about my politics. And as I'm an equal opportunity critic, I criticize both sides because I think both sides are wrong, always, anyway. But this is a good example of why people don't trust the politicians and don't trust the policy that comes from them. It's because it's selective. It's not based strictly on science. And when you take a deviation from the scientific process, now you automatically open yourself up to all the exceptions.
And to be clear, I want to back that up too, Kevin, because there's people on the right who are just nuts. You know, I saw a video just before we went on to record this. Some guy went on some conservative talk show and he said that I got vaccinated and it made me magnetic. And so the host said, well, show us that you're magnetic. So he put a penny up to his forehead and then it fell right off his head. So, So in other words, there's goofy stuff on either side, but to the extent that there are people who won't get vaccinated, there are tons of examples. Here's one more. I'm sorry. I gotta get into this. So NPR in June of 2020 ran a story. And if I wasn't quoting this, I don't think I would believe this. But so if you recall, right, there's no vaccines in June 2020. There's no antiviral drugs, which are just starting to be developed. Like they're just getting out of clinical trials right now. So NPR says the risk of congregating during a global pandemic shouldn't keep people from protesting racism, according to dozens of public health and disease experts who signed an open letter in support of the protests, which were going on last summer, right? So they said, and this is a quote from the letter, white supremacy is a lethal public health issue that predates and contributes to COVID-19, the letter said. So in other words, just as this pandemic is getting off and really starting to infect people and kill people last summer, you have a major news outlet with the backing of 50 epidemiologists saying, oh yeah, this is fine. You know, make sure you wear a mask and don't shout, you know? So like, and it's not, and again, this is not a political thing for me because I'm not a Republican. I don't care. You know, Trump's kind of whatever. But if you're like the average person at home and maybe you're already kind of skeptical of the media and then you see a story like this, you're like, okay, well, this is the greatest public health threat in however many decades. But these people can go out because they're protesting the right cause. That's just ridiculous, you know?
No, exactly. And it was the same thing as when, what was the guy's name? Don Johnson. I can't remember the representative. He's kind of a jerk. He was interrogating Fauci and he's like, well, do you mean that these protests for Black Lives Matter are okay? And Fauci wouldn't say no. You know, he was saying, well, I said, I stand by the way. He was like kind of poo-pooing the whole idea. And what he has to say as a scientist is that any mass congregation of people raises the potential for transmission. And anytime you're in a group of people where there's aerosols being generated, such as by chanting, yelling, screaming, whether it's in a Trump rally or Black Lives Matter, is an equal opportunity to spread the disease. So it's probably best to take as many precautions as necessary. That's what Fauci should have said. Instead, he kind of just dodged every question.
Yeah, absolutely. Just consistency, I guess. We've talked about this before, right? The rules apply to everybody or they don't apply to anybody.
But the thing that is most important to remember is this idea of hesitancy is important for us to keep in mind, that the people who are hesitant, who can be changed, they've been lied to by very sophisticated people with very strong messages. And we need to treat them with a little bit of compassion if we have any chance of helping them and contributing to this entire vaccination public health effort. You know, it's one thing to like ostracize somebody who's saying that, you know, who's marching with a sign saying this is Bill Gates putting 5G chips in you. You know, that's not hesitancy. The folks who are just kind of unsure, we got to earn their trust. And I think the idea of being really good with the scientific content here and being soft can really get us a long way. So, you know, I'll quit with that.
Just one final thought. I think we give the anti-vaccine people, we give them too much credit. They are very effective and they're very good at what they do. Don't get me wrong. But as of this recording, just under 80% of Americans over 12 years old, because they're not approved yet, I don't believe for anyone under that age, have at least one vaccine. And if you look at a breakdown of demographics, it's pretty consistent among all groups. They're all in the like 40-45% range. So there isn't one demographic that has been overly susceptible to this, I don't think. And then as a, like the total population at 66.6%. Now, obviously we want that to be higher, but that's pretty dang good. That's better than the average flu season, right? There's quite a few people. And then most importantly, over 65, these are the people most susceptible to a real severe case of COVID-19 and death, 97.1% are fully vaccinated. So in other words, like there's pretty good coverage here. There's always room for improvement, but I don't know. I just think the media has done a little too much to hype the anti-vaccine movement in a way that they don't deserve.
Yeah, I guess so. But at the same time, it is folks who are making a voluntary effort to not participate in a public health effort. And I can guarantee you there are collateral illnesses and death that occurred because of the refusal to obtain a vaccine. And, you know, that's just the reality of it. And if this was any other, if this would have went a different way, where if COVID-19 was a much more, or SARS-CoV-2 was a more lethal virus, which it still may become, I think you would see people running for that vaccine and pushing each other out of the way to get it, like it was a freaking Cabbage Patch Kid in 1983. I think you would be seeing people falling over each other to get it. It's the fact that it can be conveniently ignored as something you can survive that really changes the dynamics of the conversation.
To be sure, to be sure. I think, you know, we've made all the points we need to make. But now that we've said all those spicy, controversial things, let's talk about something that I think is much less objectionable, Kevin, in this idea of living longer and the relationship between genes and lifestyle choices. So tell us about this.
Yeah, this was a story that first appeared in the Washington Post and is really important because what it says is that genetics really define an endpoint that we can't surpass no matter what we do. So we've got two major things that we can, you know, do in life. You've got genetics and you've got the management of those genetics in animals. So what you have to play with, the cards you have to play with, and then the amount that you can extract from it, you know, so some set of genetics that you can maybe optimize whatever you can get out of them, or maybe not quite get their potential. And there's this idea of a mortality plateau that even people who are extremely healthy, nobody's typically making it past 100. And if you do, things kind of go downhill fast. And every year after 100, you probably have a 50-50 shot of surviving another year. And so the interest here was looking at, or at least describing, the fact that are there other factors that you can control, because you can't control that genetic endpoint. And really that's what this means the most. So when you look at this, and they look at primates, other non-human primates, I guess, or actually it would be humans too, probably, but bottom line is primatologists did this work. And when you look at human life expectancy and you look at other primates, you find that life expectancy changes because of fewer middle-aged deaths. So in other words, if you can control the things that can kill you through middle age, usually you can keep going for a bit. So things like the heart attacks and the, you know, early onset other issues. So what it really did was it said you're shifting the pool towards people who can live a long time by avoiding those kinds of disorders. The problem is that in the US, we have huge numbers of people that are actually becoming disabled under 65. So folks with weight problems, metabolic problems, heart issues, things that can be relatively controlled, maybe plus or minus with the proper intervention, but there are people who are dying earlier. And so to extend that age average, we need to be able to push these folks through middle age. And that seems to be something that can be at least somewhat controlled by behaviors.
So the article describes how different choices that you make can actually influence how your genes operate, I suppose, right? They talk about how certain things you do can turn on or turn off certain genes that influence your health, and then by extension, your lifespan. And they talk about this concept called hormesis. So can you tell us what is that? And then how does that affect how long we live?
Yeah, well, hormesis is really just a state in which how your body processes the homeostasis. Let me say this in another way, kind of just the static state of being, relative to stress. So what's coming in from how you sleep versus how you eat versus having enough water versus all that Maslow's hierarchy of needs thing on that first rung. How does the body respond to those biological needs? And maybe that's a good way to put it. And that this has an effect on gene expression that has a direct correlation and maybe even some causal threads with how we age. And the suggestion is that maybe a little bit of stress is a good thing, and that having some sort of a constant amount of something to deal with, some sort of issues to wrestle with, is a good thing. And there's folks who are doing things like plunging themselves in freezing water, you know, on a daily basis. Folks who are invoking other types of stress voluntarily, who say they see great benefit from it. And so maybe there's something to it. But this is the idea, is that a little bit of stress can go a long way.
And just to be clear, it's not like chronic stress where like you absolutely hate your job and you loathe people in your life and you're eating a bad diet. And so you constantly have heartburn and you're depressed. It's not like that. It's more like go to the gym 3 times a week and do some deadlifts or some squats. And that induces a healthy amount of acute stress, which can then help you live longer. Is that a fair summation of it?
Yeah, that's it. So the idea of acute stress, and when they talk about this, the idea of doing something like 30 minutes of high intensity interval training per week. So just like you say, heavy weights, low reps, that kind of thing, a lot of walking. The Mayo Clinic, they actually said that people who played sports were 40% less likely to die than those who exercise often, you know, in that age cohort. The Miracle Whip Clinic, on the other hand, I always throw that in when we talk about the Mayo Clinic, right? The number one thing, so they found that exercise and this kind of idea of high intensity training could have an effect, but the number one thing that seemed to have a profound effect on longevity, having a close partner.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because I've of course this is just an anecdote, but getting married to someone who I love, who's a good match for me, is probably the best thing I've ever done in terms of just having a balanced lifestyle and being able to cope with challenges that everyone faces. But it appears that this extends to everybody. And I think one of the scientists they quoted said, you know, I haven't had one good husband. I've had two. So talk a little bit about this, because there's always a tendency in the sciences to sort of separate the psychological aspects of our health from our physical aspects. And I think that's a holdover from a different era when you're like, oh, well, the real scientists, you know, we talk about genes and stuff, and you fluffy psychiatrists, you talk about feelings and, you know, so talk about how these two things are connected very clearly.
Yeah, it really does seem to appear that those things are connected, that folks who have less to worry about, and the stress is good in some ways, but when that stress comes in other ways, you find folks who lose optimism. And there's been a lot of studies that have been done with people who live in poverty, usually die at a younger age, in part because of less optimism. You know, that's probably part of it, but also other choices that, you know, are limited by access. But in general, this idea of optimism seems to really be able to play an important role, that having a good forward outlook in life tends to allow you to extend it. And that's kind of interesting, but it totally makes sense.
Yeah, I'd have to look this up, but I remember reading at some point about something called broken heart syndrome, which I believe is an actual diagnosis. It has a fancier medical name, but it's a real phenomenon that, you know, the way you feel and the experiences you have, that trauma that you experience can trigger physical symptoms, which is interesting. So I'll look that up. Don't quote me on that, but it's an interesting. But
along that line though, there's a lot of good data that says once somebody in a spousal pair dies, the other one usually takes the dirt nap not far behind. And that's pretty well shown, especially in the elderly, like folks who've been together for a long time. When one of them checks out, the other one has usually got one foot in the grave. And lots of examples of that.
Yeah, well, there you go. Maybe it's more established than I thought. I was just trying to be careful. But there you go. That's why you do a podcast with a scientist.
Because they can be uncareful.
Yes. Yes. And then they have a PhD, so it's okay. Yeah. I'm kidding. Don't quote me on that source watch.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. Final story for the day. So how the brain drives food addictions.
Yeah, this is cool. And this was written by Tom Siegfried on October 14th. And really what it boils down to is a different take on the things that we already know very well. So you have to forgive me a bit if I depart from the article. But what Siegfried talks about is this idea that ultra-processed foods play into many human maladies and what he calls food addiction. So there's a couple things to take apart here. Is it really an addiction? And Siegfried makes the contention that it doesn't really matter if it's really a physiological addiction where you have negative consequences of a dependence on a given substance. So in other words, like a formal addiction, opioids, alcohol, you come off it, you can have negative consequences. Other things like tobacco, yeah, they make you want another one, but and maybe you got some problems, you know, difficulties coming off it. But that's a good addiction. What am I thinking here? A good example of a non-addiction would be something like sugar. You know, I really like chocolate, and so I'm addicted to chocolate. No one's really addicted to chocolate. And that's so a couple of points he makes here inside this article. The main thing is that when we talk about the stuff in processed food, we're talking about salt, sugar, and fat. And there's a really good book on this. I can't remember the author's name, but the bottom line is that these are three things that were rather rare in human evolution. That when we were running the savannas and hunting and gathering, you really didn't find salt, sugar, or fat. And when you did, you indulged. And your brain learned that, and we evolved to learn, that when you had salt, sugar, and fat, that you would eat as much of it as you could. Because this was the stuff that would get you through the long season, through long periods of fasting, through the spells where there was no food available, this high energy, calorically rich stuff that allowed us to put on weight for later was the stuff that you would gorge upon if you wanted to survive. And this is what shaped our brains and our behaviors. So enter the modern era where you can go get salt, sugar, and fat in one package, you know, in a brown bag they hand to you out of a window in a drive-thru. And now you start seeing, okay, well, what's the deal with obesity? You know, why is this happening? And it's because salt, sugar, and fat are feeding these evolutionarily derived centers of our brain that were made to respond and want the stuff in that bag.
So not to sound like a fast food lobbyist here, which I'm probably going to do anyway, but whatever. To what extent are people responsible for these decisions, you know? So, and I put myself in the same category. I used to be really overweight as a kid. And then at one point in my life, I just said, I have to change my lifestyle or I'm not going to live very long for one thing, like we were talking about, but I'm just not going to have as great a quality life as I could. And so because of that, I had the motivation to eat less crappy food and go exercise more. And it works. So I guess the point I'm making is to what extent can we overcome these sorts of challenges? Because they're real, you know, like if you've ever had a Snickers bar, like that first bite of a bite of a Snickers bar when you're hungry, it tastes amazing, you know? So this is a real phenomenon that the article is describing, but I don't like even talking about it in the realm of addiction seems a little bit of a stretch to me. Am I wrong about that?
Well, it really satisfies. No, it's the there was the Snickers really satisfied. That was your old thing. So, but this is where you start looking at things like what are the measures of addiction? And when they've done this work at Yale, they start to look at how food and substance abuse line up together. and that addiction isn't really just a one category thing. It has multiple facets that are involved, and any subset of those that you may subscribe to could indicate addiction. And really what it says is that the presence of these, what they call hyperpalatable foods, do satisfy those addictive criteria. And so that's really his point here, is that we're taking something that wasn't available in human evolution, we're providing it in very easy, accessible, and concentrated ways. We're seeing its negative effects, and also seeing behaviors around those products that are reminiscent of addictive behaviors.
Interesting. So maybe there's a parallel there, but it's not quite the same thing. And I think you alluded to this earlier, right? Someone who's addicted to opioids has a different level of challenge in front of them than someone who just can't quit eating Snickers bars. You know, maybe, is that the right way to look at it? Like, these things exist on a spectrum. They're like, they're influenced by the same biochemical factors and behavioral factors, what have you, but they're just not as severe as some others might be. Is that a fair way to look at it?
I think so. But that goes back to, you know, our original idea in the beginning about genes and their effect on physiological processes. Everybody's different. And how any one person will be affected by a set of genetics that integrate with a desire for a specific food item or a specific element of food, you know, that all remains to be resolved. The main thing is just to be cognizant of the idea that the companies that are providing fast and cheap calories know that they can wrap it in these compounds that are really, I guess, desired by the human brain based on evolution, lack of availability. And so today we're just gorging on the stuff that was once scarce, and that the author feels is at least part of the problem with why we have issues of obesity and other metabolic issues associated with it.
Certainly. Well, an evolving discussion. I'm sure we'll revisit this because more studies are going to come out. But in the meantime, Kevin, who are you following on Twitter this week?
Well, it's kind of a little bit of a dark horse one here. That's a good one, is Klaus Ammann. And Klaus, it's KLAUSAMMANN. And Klaus, he really is a frequent tweeter, but more of a retweeter. He goes and finds good stuff and then shares it. And I definitely think he's a good follow. I learn a lot of good stuff from his tweets. I find a lot of great links, and he doesn't have that many followers. So let's see if we can pump him up to 300. What about you?
I may have recommended this gentleman before, but I'm going to encourage people to follow Dr. Joe Schwartz, who is the director of the McGill Office for Science and Society. And he is useful in the sense that he goes and takes apart really important issues that, like we were talking about at the beginning with vaccine skepticism, they seem compelling to someone who doesn't know any better. So, for example, I was doing some research on Stephanie Seneff earlier this week, she's big in the anti-GMO and the anti-vax world. I think we've talked about her before, but she had this idea that glyphosate was a contributor to the COVID-19 pandemic because, and I kid you not, I'm not making this up, farmers spray glyphosate on their crops, and then some of those crops go into biofuel production. And so when engines burn this biofuel, they emit aerosolized glyphosate, which gets into people's lungs and causes the symptoms of COVID-19. I'm sorry. I couldn't even get through it. But anyway, so, you know, for someone like me, I know that's ridiculous, but the scientific details have to be investigated, and that takes time. But Joe Schwartz went in and he just said, this is stupid. Glyphosate would not survive combustion in an engine. And then and then there was a few other things. You know, he said, well, one thing, the amount of glyphosate that you would hypothetically be exposed to, it's not going to cause these symptoms for X, Y, and Z reasons. So, and all that to say, he's been enormously helpful in my work. So at Joe Schwartz on Twitter.
Yeah, he's really good. And he's been at it now for probably 38, 39 years. on the radio every weekend in Montreal. And I used to be able to get his show in the form of a podcast, and unfortunately can't do it now, but it's definitely worth listening to.
Yeah. Just Google him or follow him on Twitter. Lots of good stuff. And it's educational, you know, and we all like learning things. I think that's why people turn into this podcast. So with that out of the way, we're gonna leave it there. Thank you guys so much. Follow us as well at Kevin Folta. You can follow my writing at ACSH.org on Twitter, CameronJEnglish.net. Podcast is on iTunes and Spotify. Tell your friends, give us lots of stars, positive reviews. Thank you so much, and we'll see you next week.